accession number 21014, Reel 2.
Frank Burton, Reel 2.
As I say, 4-5 Commando was formed, and the advantage of being in the commandos, although we didn't realise it when we volunteered, was that most of the time you lived in civilian billets. When you were moving to a particular area, you'd have an officer and a few men would go into the nearest town and ask the people in the towns to, if they would take two or three or four or whatever into their homes. And we received, on top of our pay, we received 6 and 8 pence a day extra. That was to cover our lodging allowance. We were fed by our landladies. And, well, they did more than feed us very often. Did our ironing and whatever. We paid our landladies with £2.68 a week we had on top of our pay, and we paid our landladies 30 shillings per week. Some of the chaps didn't pay anything. People wouldn't take money off them. Probably they might have been glad to have us because they got more ration coupons, which if you think about it, the more you had in your family, the more ration coupon you had, and you could make the food go further. But we had some very good billets. We were at Eastbourne for two stays, probably about 3-4 months each time. Bexhill, then we went to Ayr in Scotland. We'd done quite a bit of training up in Scotland, and then we went to Ayr, and you were really training then. You were doing the speed marches, the 30-mile marches, landing exercises, well, everything that had to be done. We had a very good time at Ayr because we happened to be there at New Year, which was quite enjoyable. And from Ayr, we went to Achnacarry in Scotland. That was mainly to pass out as commandos. That was hard going because you ran everywhere. Even going to your meals, you ran. And that was December 1943. And all the instructors were all experienced commandos who'd been on the raids and everything. And one of the frightening things that we met us when we went through the main gates for each side of the road, there were graves. You might have heard of these, with the crosses on, which frightened us a bit at that moment, until you read what was on the crosses. Such things as this man died because he forgot to do so-and-so and things like that, which made you think. Because lots of accidents did happen. But that was the real hard part, was the passing out. You had to do cliff climbing, all the rope climbing, speed marches, and fortunately I passed. Quite a few didn't. They're good soldiers, but I had one particular friend who had no head for heights. He couldn't climb, and he failed. But he was a good soldier, big man, very fit. So, fortunately, I passed. And things went on from there. I can't remember where we went after Acme Carry. We went to the Isle of Wight. That would be 1944, for about 6 weeks. And whilst I was there, they asked for volunteers. This is me volunteering again. To go on a march, 150-mile march it was to be, testing dehydrated rations. They had a small box which contained dehydrated ration, little blocks of, one was a little block of oatmeal that you put into hot water which expanded, so that was your breakfast. Little cubes of, like OXO, the size of an OXO cube, which was your tea, sugar and milk all in one. So we went up to Wick. I can't remember how many Marines from our commander went, but there was a mixture of airborne troops and other troops from other regiments. And we started from Wick on the east coast of Scotland and went, marched across country, of course, across the mountains, and very seldom marched along a road. You didn't see any people. You were right out in the wilderness, and we existed on these 10 boxes. We had 10 boxes. The march lasted 10 days. We slept out every night in the open with no buildings to shelter into. And being a signaller, I had a big radio on my back and all my equipment to last me for 10 days, ground sheet, blanket, all your equipment. And I couldn't carry my 10 boxes, so 10 of the other chaps had to take one of my boxes, and each day they would, one of them would hand me my box of rations. And very heavy equipment. You were weighed, you couldn't sit down with your equipment on if you had a rest, it was too heavy. We had a team of doctors with us. They went by road every day. They didn't march with us. And we were weighed every morning before we set off, and weighed when we finished in the evening. I suppose we probably averaged about 15 miles a day. Might have been a bit more one day, less the next day. But the weather was good. And I enjoyed it. It was good, great. We slept out, the weather was fine. And these dehydrated rations were quite sufficient. You didn't have any else. You never saw a slice of bread or anything. There was nothing. That was your rations for 24 hours.
Did you like the rations?
Well, I wouldn't say we liked them, but that was all you had. I suppose it wasn't what you would have chosen to eat. But then again, sometimes different places where you were, food was very poor.
Where did you get the water from to hydrate
well,
them?
Well, you would get up from streams, or and you you'd fill your water bottle, or if you stopped, if you had to, you got to get have a meal, your breakfast or something like that. I can't remember. You were probably near water, and you had a little sort of stove where you put a tablet. You lit this tablet and you had heated your water or your food on this little, only a little thing about the size of a cup, of a mug. And
did you have purifying tablets?
Yes, we did. Yes, you'd fill your water bottle up for the day and put your purifying tablets in it. And then
what kind of foods were in the packs?
Probably little blocks of a sort of a, probably made a little stew or soup, things like that. Probably a few sweets, hard biscuits. But I suppose we never, all through your training, you never had a great lot of food. Food was very often poor, so this was no hardship, living off these rations. And we finished the march at Achnacarry. And we had a fortnight's leave then. So then we went back to the Isle of Wight. And from the Isle of Wight, we probably went to Eastbourne, I should think, into billets, civilian billets. And when you, at those days, it was just like going to work. You reported to your HQ, which might be a mile and a half away from where you lived. You would report to your HQ at 8:30, 9 o'clock in the morning, and go off and do different little exercises, training with your radios, and then every so often you had a big exercise, a commando exercise, where you might be away for 3 days, things like that. And I say we went to, I think we went back up to Scotland, did a lot of landing exercises. And I can remember leaving, well, we all remember leaving Scotland. We left Oban on board a troop ship with landing craft slung on the sides. We got out into the open sea, into a force nine gale. And of course the ship was going up and down, up and down. We got down as far as Milford Haven, tried to pull in at Milford Haven, sent two tugs out, I think it was, to try and tow us into Milford Haven, but couldn't. And we were told that they were going to try and turn the ship round at 3 o'clock. I'll never forget that. 3 o'clock in the afternoon, they were going to try and turn the ship round and go back to Liverpool. And they did. They did manage it. How they ever managed it without the ship turning over, I don't know. But everybody on board was sick. All the crew was sick. And it was absolutely chaos below decks. But we did get back to Liverpool, which was great for me, because I had a few hours at home. And from there we travelled by train, finished the journey by train down, back down to Eastbourne, I think it was. Yeah, that's where we were heading, Eastbourne. And training went on. We trained part of the time near, around Arundel, which was similar sort of country to Normandy, although we didn't know anything about Normandy at the time, didn't know anything. But with the River Arun and the similar sort of countryside. And then the time came when you left Eastbourne and came down to Southampton, to Southampton Common, and we were behind barbed wire in tents on the common, armed sentries marching up and down the avenue, Southampton the avenue in Southampton, keep civilians away from us. We had no idea. We knew we were going somewhere. We had no idea where. But we were briefed there. We had all the models laid out that they used for briefing. And we had 2 weeks there. Weren't allowed out at all. And then on June the 5th, we had our midday meal and then went down to Wasatch on the Hamble there to board the landing craft. And my landing craft was the LSI's, Landing Craft Infantry. Mine was 518. And we left Wasatch, sailed throughout the night, most of it being seasick, it was quite choppy. And it's a day you'd never forget. There were so many ships of all kinds, battleships, cruisers, destroyers, everything, rocket ships, all the landing craft. The sight you'd never see again. I'm sure you wouldn't. And as our craft, as we got near, we were going in line, well, our landing craft, in line, heading for the beach. And some little way off the beach, we got hit. A shell, I suppose, must have been a shell. And we didn't have a lot of landing craft, had a door that dropped down where the troops ran off. We had two ramps that the crew put down. As soon as we hit the beach, these ramps were put down and we got down the ramps. Very difficult. It's just like trying to get down two ladders, get down the ladder.
You mean the ramps were put over the side?
They were down at the bow of the ship. Either side, so you get two lines of off at once.
But you had to go over the side?
No, we didn't go over the side. No, you moved up the landing craft and went down these two ramps at the front. And but we got hit as we were going into the beach. We got hit, and the four crew, the four matlows, whose job it was to put the ramps down. They were going forward to get the ramps ready, and they were killed outright when we got hit. And the skipper shouted out, "Get behind the bridge," because it wasn't much of a bridge. Some were down below. I can't remember whether I was down below or on deck. And then we received another hit, which killed, I don't know how many, probably three or four maybe, of our commando. And it was very difficult getting off down these ramps. We had so much equipment. I had this large radio on my back and your other equipment. And our orders were to leave the landing craft and run, get off the beach, and I was, what, 20 year old then, and seeing these four crew of the landing craft killed, that was the first thing I'd ever seen as death. I'd never seen anybody dead before. There were bodies floating in the water, and men on the beach killed, wounded. But our orders were to get off the beach. We just ran. Our adjutant was inland with his hunting horn, blowing his hunting horn, and we sort of all gathered, made for the to join up together. A lot of them probably didn't make it. We were being mortared at the time. You're under fire. And our objective was to get to Pegasus Bridge to join up with the airborne, who landed by glider just after midnight. And we got near to the bridge, because I forgot to tell you that my job, as soon as 4-5 was formed, I got the job of the commanding officer's signaller, always referred to as the CO's rover. It was where he went, I went. Well, most places anyway. And it was Colonel Charles Rees who was the commanding officer at the time. And as we got near to Pegasus Bridge, he was badly wounded.
How did that happen?
Well, it was said to be a sniper, but I don't really know, because there was a lot of action going on at the time. And they took him away. He eventually returned to England. And Major Gray took over as commanding officer, which eventually promoted to lieutenant colonel. And I became his rover then.
Were you there when Charles Rees was shot?
Yeah. Yeah, it's just close by. They said it was a sniper, but, well, it could have been, I don't know, we don't know. Just knew he was hit, badly wounded, wherever.
Can you draw a picture of what happened from your memory?
Not really, it was just, I suppose, it was what you might call mayhem, really. There was so much action going on. Because the airborne had captured the bridge, Pegasus Bridge, but the Germans were still attacking to try and regain the bridge. And as I say, Major Gray took over as commanding officer, and I went with him. And as D-Day, we crossed over the bridge, and we're marching down a road, single file on each side of the road, and it was probably late afternoon, and we came under fire, heavy fire, and we all jumped into the ditch on either side of the road, and under fire for quite a while. Lay there. Eventually, our signaller's officer crawled along to us and told us to stay there. He said, "Don't move, stay here. I'm going to try and find out what's happening." So off he went, and eventually things quietened down, and we looked up. And everybody had gone. Lieutenant Nelson, our signal officer, didn't come back. He apparently was wounded. He got wounded when he left us. So I should think there was about 8 of us on our own. So we didn't know which way to go. We didn't know, because it all moved out away silently. We didn't know where the rest of them had gone. So the day we found a small bunch of trees where we spent the night. And early the next morning, I had the radio, I switched the radio on. Silly, really. I switched it on to see if I could find out where everybody else was. Well, thinking about it now, they wouldn't give that information out over the radio. I was getting to hear messages, and we decided to move off in this direction to try and find the rest of the unit. And we were just moving off when one of the number 10 commando, we had probably about 5 chaps from number 10 commando, the international commando, joined us at Eastbourne. And we didn't know anything about them. We were always told not to ask them any questions. But they acted as interpreters, and they would go off foraging around trying to get information from the local people. Anyway, we were just about to move off, and this number 10 commando chap found us. And as it happened, we would have gone in the wrong direction. The rest of the commando were behind us. So we did get back then. So that was a relief. Then there was the big battery at Merville. You probably heard about it. That the airborne had captured. I think the Germans regained it at some time, and we had to go in, or the commando had to go in, to clear it out. But then we had, if I can remember rightly, we bypassed it. I wasn't attached to any troop, I was just following the CO all the time. And we had to go to attack and capture this small seaside town, not much bigger than a village really, Franceville Plage, it was called. And that was heavy fighting. I think we had 35 men killed in that one little action.
Can you give a description of the fighting?
Well, I was with the CO and the regimental sergeant major and the Corporal Watson. As it happened, he was a pay clerk. Now, you think of a pay clerk who'd be way behind the lines, but they had to pick up their rifles just the same as everybody else and fight. And we were going down this road, a lot of action going on. There was the four of us, the RSM, Corporal, CO and myself, and there was one loud explosion beside us. You know, forget it. And the CO and I just ran and got under cover behind a wall, if I remember rightly. But later on we found out that the RSM and Corporal Watson were being killed outright. So the CO and I were very fortunate to come out of that.
What had caused the explosion?
Well, it was said to be an anti-tank gun that had fired. Whether it was or not, we don't know. It was a real loud explosion. Probably a Could have been a mortar or whatever. And then we were ordered back to Merville. And we dug in there, dug slit trenches.